This podcast includes strong language, descriptions of war, and deals with issues of trauma and death.
Everything went into slow motion, and I knew instantly when my left foot touched the ground that it wasn't right.
He was very calm in a situation where he could have had every right to lose his composure, lose his bearing, but he stayed professional throughout the whole ordeal, even as he was coming in and out of consciousness.
It's not a friendship. It's a brotherhood, and that's something that you endure together. And we have become family. Pete, Nick, and I, the three of us, have become very close.
What is it that drives people to be brave? To commit acts of heroism, often in the face of the enemy? I'm Darren Coventry, former soldier and now video and podcast producer at BFBS. I've been talking to men and women who've received the UK's highest military honours. We talk about what happened, what they thought at the time, and how they feel about it now. This is TN Medals.
Major Pete Norton, formerly of the Royal Logistic Corps and recipient of the George Cross. Thanks for coming. It's a real honour to meet you.
Thanks for inviting me along. It's a real pleasure to be here.
The most important question, regardless of everything else, is how do you take your broom?
Oh, definitely a Julie Andrews, White Nun, please.
Brilliant. We need a kind of a chart, I think, of how everyone takes it. Maybe it needs to appear in the video somewhere. So, Pete, you served in the army in a job that some people might, you know, understand and know as a bomb disposal, but your official title would have been an ammunition technician, and then later as an ammunition technical officer, ATO.
Yep.
So tell us about that. Tell us about your job.
It was a bit weird because it was never really meant to be. It had never been my intention. I'd always wanted actually to join the Air Force as a pilot. But unfortunately, a family doctor at some point in my childhood had written that I'd got asthma. And as there were no recruiting issues at all at that point, all they did was take one look at that on the documents and wouldn't even consider me for any further. So that was a bit of kick in the teeth. Sit back and think about what one wants to do. I ended up leaving partway through my A-levels at school because I wasn't enjoying it. It wasn't really firing all of my rockets, as it were. So after a little period working in Civvy Street, I decided to join the army. My brother had been in for a little while and he was enjoying it. So initially I applied for a commission in the Royal Army Ordnance Corps and went to Blackdown Barracks in January 83 as a potential officer cadet to do a 3-month potential officer cadet course. That was fantastic fun. Really put through the mill for 3 months. Lots of fizz, lots of leadership tasks, lots of high stress situations to be put into, constantly being assessed. And then went forward to regular commissions board at Westbury. They took a look at me there and unfortunately turned around and said, "We think you've got something, but go away and finish your A-levels." Well, I'd already taken that decision that I didn't want to do the A-levels. Myself, along with a couple of other guys that had done the POC course with me and got the same sort of knockback deferral, all three of us decided that we'd enjoyed the 3 months so much we were going to join up as soldiers. So the Ordnance Corps offered us the trade of ammunition technician. It was the only one that they really wanted us to go into because of the educational requirements and the fact that it gave us the most money. It was a technical trade. So we all signed up for that, and after doing full another 3 months of proper basic training to become qualified soldiers, we then went on to our trade training and passed out as ammunition technicians class 2.
Pete completed his training and left as a Lance Corporal. He was posted to 5 Ordnance Battalion in Germany, where he ended up working at 5-2 Ordnance Company. Postings followed for Pete in the normal army fashion at the time, moving every few years between Northern Ireland and Germany. By 1986, he was the senior ammunition technician responsible for bomb disposal in Northern Ireland. Eventually, he reached the rank of WO1 conductor, at the time one of the most senior soldier appointments in the British Army and a real testament to his knowledge and experience. Pete then commissioned and took up an appointment as a captain at RAF Witton in Cambridgeshire, looking after ground-to-air weapon systems. But he soon found his way back to the army.
I actually got pulled out of Witten a year early. There was a manning issue in the 11 EOD regiment, so I got pulled back into 11 EOD and went to Ashchurch, which was the headquarters of 71 EOD squadron, and assumed the role of 2IC of the squadron there. Had to sub in there as the OC for 6 months initially on arrival because the OC had to deploy on something else. But then it was pretty obvious that soon I was going to get pulled out to go and support an operation either in Afghanistan, which was looming, or as was more likely and as it turned out, to support operations in Iraq.
You're now at Ashchurch and then you deploy to Iraq.
Yep. So you had to be a late entry captain. So
and that's because of your experience.
Yeah, so you bring all that experience with you, both from Northern Ireland and having sort of come up through the ranks and done weapons in before, to assist them and guide them in setting up and running this unit. And the Americans are very good at this. You know, they bring all the manpower and the money to the party. In this instance, we bring the experience, but then very soon they learn from you and they just start running away with it and bringing in more money and making it much bigger than we could. Yeah. But essentially, it's the same sort of things we used to do in Northern Ireland with our bomb intelligence team, which then became weapons intelligence teams and weapon intelligence company. And it's basically to find out what is the enemy doing, how are they doing it, what they're using, who are they? And it's a combination of technical and biometric intelligence that helps you identify and hopefully defeat the enemy.
Yeah, so it's real like intelligence at the cutting edge of operations. You know, it's really affecting every aspect of almost how vehicles are built, how troops move around, and
it's all done by a very diverse team that's brought together. You know, that so that whole sexy unit, as I say, you know, you've got US Navy personnel, you've got US Army personnel, you've got British Army personnel, some Australian Army personnel, you've got civilians from USA, various US agencies, you've got FBI guys there, all working together to get that same job done.
And it's two of those FBI guys who are an important part of this story.
My name is Nicholas Beauchers, and I'm a supervisory special agent with the FBI, and I've been with the FBI since 1999. In 2005, I was a line special agent, bomb technician, and I was deployed to Iraq in support of the Combined Explosives Exploitation Cell, and essentially was assigned there for about 3 months.
My name is Christopher Rogopoulos. I'm an FBI supervisory special agent bomb technician. I work in the explosives unit in the FBI laboratory. I've been an agent since 1997, so, you know, a pretty full career there.
Pete met Nick and Chris, who is also known as Rigo, when he joined the Combined Explosives Exploitation Cell, SEXE.
C-E-X-E. Yes, you put that together, it's sexy, right? And literally they were calling, you know, the guys, say the sexy guys are here, and we couldn't shake it, so we had to own it. So we actually embraced it, and that became our thing. It is what it is.
So our primary mission at that time was in working with our coalition partners, specifically United Kingdom, as well as Australia. We were present to conduct post-blast investigations to determine when there was a complex attack or the potential use of sophisticated improvised explosive devices. Our role was to conduct essentially a preliminary on-scene investigation, not only to gather facts or gather evidence, but also to kind of do an examination of the tactics, techniques, and procedures in order to try to keep our forces safe and at the same time attempt in every way possible forensically and investigatively to determine who the individuals were that were actually building those devices.
Through that type of work, continual exposure to the trends and the movement of those TTPs, we would hopefully get information and have opinions we could present back to the armed forces and give them an idea of what's happening so they could adjust their tactics as well to prevent more attacks and save lives and just kind of be in front of it.
So the unit itself depended really what was going on. In some cases, most of the unit might deploy in two Humvees, which would typically be about 10 people deploying at a go. But actually on a day-to-day basis, we developed this sort of system where actually we might just deploy as a team of five in one vehicle so that you're not constantly all going out. And because it's literally day on every time, maybe four or five times a day in some cases, occasional quiet days, but most days were quite busy.
We're here to talk about your award of the George Cross. But I think it's worth talking about some of the other stuff that happened on that tour before we get to that. Because it was, as you say, it was a very hectic, busy tour.
Well, day one was a great example. Literally sort of got off the Herc, was met by the guy that I was replacing, taken back. And within half an hour, basically unpacked my kit, got my assault vest all ready to go and everything's rock and rolling. And half an hour later, we're out. And in the first 2 days, I think it was five car bombs and suicide bombs and the like that we deployed to.
Yeah.
And that was it. That was straight in to the job. And
baptism
it continued.
Of fire? Is that
pretty much, yeah, yeah. And there were a number of occasions where either myself and my team or the other team were out there and, you know, you get car bombs going off quite close or there'd be RPGs fired into your area.
Yeah, and Baghdad was a real Wild West
at
that
time. It was pretty, yeah.
You know, one incident that I did read about was about a suicide vest that you were looking at.
So all the local EOD teams would send in their stuff that they'd rendered safe so that it could then be exploited. And a lot of the exploitation we did was, if it wasn't something particularly high threat or high priority at the time, then we'd have a quick look at it and triage it. And if it was safe, etc., then it would actually get boxed up, sent back to the UK or US for the full exploitation. But of course, that triage thing, that was also part of my daily job when I was not deployed out on the ground, was triaging the stuff that came through. And I got to at the bottom of this box that had turned up. There was this sort of fairly standard sort of looking suicide vest, a lot of American C4, which had obviously been captured or found stolen from somewhere. Loads of ball bearings on the front. And then I found out it was about seven detonators still inside of it. They hadn't been removed or anything. It's like, probably ought to do something about this.
See, I imagine this now is, you know, cameras rolling, Hollywood movie stuff. It's like, better sort this out.
No, it was better sort this out. So took some photos before I took it apart and then just started cutting it open with a scalpel and getting them out, basically just to reduce the danger. Because it was literally in our triage area next to the office. And,
yeah. I think that, you know, from what I've heard about you and talked to some of your friends, as we'll discuss, you know, that kind of epitomises your cool nature, by the sounds of it. Were you cool?
I think it annoys my wife sometimes. Have you ever seen The Bridge of Spies with Tom Hanks and the Russian spy that gets caught? And a number of times during the film, he turns around and says, "Are you not worried?" And the response is, "Would it help?"
No. Well, that's true. I mean, it's a really good way to look at it. But that gets us on to the 24th of July. And you were working with your team at Sexy, and you got called to a serious incident which involved a unit from the 121st Georgia National Guard, which I'm assuming is quite a routine shout for you guys.
Well, yeah, this was a classic one. So the Sunday, it was actually a fairly quiet day up until that point. And I think it was late afternoon when the first call came through. So we just had to get the team together, and we did the same sort of, again, just deployed as a small team. So in this case, one vehicle, five of us in it. So there's myself, there's Nick Beauchiers, who's FBI, Chris Rigopoulos, FBI, Ken Chisholm, who's ATF, Andrew Martin, who is Australian Army.
And so at the time, if you can picture, obviously a very dusty environment, where often you couldn't see but a few meters ahead of you. Temperature was in excess of 50 degrees C. And, you know, you're wearing about 25 to 30 kilos of kit and cramped into armored vehicles and essentially going outside the protection of the base to conduct our job. And so we did that obviously with the support of the military to ensure that we were safe and that we were able to get our job completed as quickly as possible. Unfortunately, it's a high threat environment. We were going to places where attacks had just taken place, where it had taken place very recently. So we were constantly under the threat of potentially taking hostile fire or what we would consider follow-on devices.
So we drove basically about 15 minutes without leaving camp just to get to 48 Brigade Combat Team's ops center. Got a briefing in there as to what was happening. And ideally, really, would have liked to have deployed onto the ground straight away. Still daylight, always good to get out on the ground in daylight so you can see what's going on. But you've also got to sort of work with the unit who are trying to control what for them is obviously quite a traumatic time.
I suppose there's a lot going on, and a lot of different moving parts.
And they wanted to get recovery section out there because they'd got, you know, basically the remains of a vehicle and a load of other equipment and body parts and all that which needed recovery. So instead of us just going out there with our American MP escort that we normally had, we were sat around for quite a while actually waiting for this recovery team to be able to join us and go out as a convoy to the scene. So by the time we got to the scene, it was early evening and it had already got dark, which is never ideal, but you know it is what it is. You've got to do the job. So it's about probably about 6K southwest of Bayap, so not that far out of Camp Victory, really. But it's a very flat, open, rural area, a lot of agriculture going on, a lot of big irrigation ditches traversing that whole area. And as the incident was on this one long road that runs east to west, and basically earlier that day, they'd had a vehicular patrol going along there, and I think it was second or third off the top of memory, I'm not certain. Humvee got hit by this massive buried IED. Whether it was Kamanwa or RCID, I don't know. But it was one or the other. And it just destroyed the Humvee. Largest part that was left really was the engine block with the front sort of axle attached. The rest of it, equipment, and unfortunately the occupants were just spread for 50 metres all over the place. So when we arrived, the unit had already been on the ground for quite some time. Obviously, they're trying to secure the routes in, make sure nobody can get in and out. As I say, very wide open area, they're open to attack.
They're under threat.
Yeah, they're under threat constantly. Could have been indirect mortar fire, pre-flight rockets, could have been a suicide vehicle bomb, IED.
And all these things happened all the time.
So they're happening constantly, every day, everything you go to.
So the soldiers are really on edge.
Yeah.
They know.
And at the same time, they're on edge, but we know that we've got to get the job done as quickly as possible to get them out of the way so they're not under threat. And they've already been there for quite a long time. So we turn up, we stop short where we can see the guys at the side of the road, and do our 5s and 25s straight away. So for those that are not aware, 5s and 25, 5 metre check. First thing you do when you stop out on operations in that sort of threat area is 5 minute look before you even get out. You're looking out the windows. Is there anything around here I should be suspicious of? Doesn't matter that a unit's already there. You do it all the time, every time, so that it becomes second nature. You don't want to be in a situation where the guys are wondering if this is a job where I should do a check or shouldn't do a check. You just do it automatically.
Well, 5s and 20s have actually made their way into military.
Yeah, well, it used to be 5s and 20s in Northern Ireland. In Iraq, it was 5s and 25s. So basically, once you've done that initial five, there's nothing that I can see around here that's a threat. Then the guys get out, do a walk around that five, physically check the five, make sure there's nothing that they're not happy with. And then if we think we're going to be in that particular location for a while, we'll then extend it out to do a full 25 check. So we've sort of done that. And I'm talking to the guy that sort of identified himself as the incident commander at the time, and he's giving me a brief on what's going on. And in front of me, basically, there's a... within the confines of what you can see in the dark is a scene of devastation and lots of glow sticks. And basically what they've done is they've gone around and marked all the body parts and hazardous items such as ammunition, grenades, etc. with these glow sticks. So it's quite a surreal scene in front of me at the time. What would often happen at scenes is once we've got the information we need, I've got one of my team acting as a scribe, which was Drew Martin, the Aussie. I would have basically said, right, this is what we're going to do, guys. This is the plan. We're going to get in, exploit the scene, gather what we need, whether that be samples from the seat of the explosion, i.e. the crater, because if we gather samples there, chemical analysis can give us an idea of what was used, what type of explosive, etc. Maybe if we identify any fragments and the like, we collect those up as well. All depends on the job itself.
So you asked the guys to stay behind in the safe area, and you went forward by yourself.
I ended up doing a one-man walk down, which is kind of how normally in Northern Ireland we would never all go in as a team. That was just something that had developed in Iraq, really. So I did this one-man walk around. I'd gone down the right-hand side, big crater in the middle of the road. But what I was really concerned about was that sort of verges down both sides of the road, where it'd be easy to conceal something, particularly an antenna for a receiver or something like that. And I was using just a combination, really, of white light, night vision equipment, etc. and doing a careful, slow walk around. I was on my way back towards the hard top when just everything went into slow motion. And I knew instantly when my left foot touched the ground that it wasn't right. And that was just followed by this massive explosion. A feeling of being thrown through the air, just really fast, hard wind, hot, punching past me. Eventually landing, seeing, you know, you see films where it goes into slow motion. Clearly it doesn't, but I think actually when your body and your mind suddenly finds itself in a situation like that, I don't know, maybe it's got a different, it switches to a different mode where it just processes everything so much faster that it seems like it's happening in slow motion.
Yeah. It's one of those moments where, you know, you can once again replay it in your mind 100 times and, you know, where were you or how did you react? Well, in this case, the IED functioned and it knocked all of us to the ground. That's how close we were to this. Because remember, we were standing near a Humvee, you know, and Pete was within visual distance of us. And it was a night job. So, you know, now it's like, now what do you do, right? That's where your training once again kicks back in and you have to react.
And so there was obviously some smoke. It was obviously dark. And, you know, it was milliseconds after that, that, you know, Chris called out, you know, hey, Pete, are you good? We didn't hear anything. And so as Chris started forward, I moved forward with him.
I think I landed head first, but thank God I had my helmet on. And obviously I had got the wind enormously knocked out of me. And I think probably could have easily died if I'd just relaxed. But I was on the deck there and I thought about my kids, my boys, and getting back home to them. And then probably seen too many war films over the years, but the only thing that came to mind then was just to shout out loud, medic. Really just to let them know where I was.
So, you know, he's not where he was. Where is he? And that's one of those moments where you're starting to scan. You know, it's once again, it's dark and smoky and things. I could hear him very close by, and he flew in the air probably about 20-something feet away from the secondary blast. So I went directly to that site, and once again, having done this type of work for a long, long time, and also having been on the firefighter with our Rural Metro Fire Department, you know, having seen many trauma scenes and reacted as a medical responder, you know, you've seen it all until you haven't, right? Well, in this case, it was quite unique for me personally, because now it's my guy. It's always been somebody else. But today it was my guy that was injured, right? And it was those moments. You know, there's my TL, my team leader. It's horrific, traumatic injuries. His one leg was gone. His arm was mangled, he's bleeding out, you know, and he's still, you know, lucid, he's, you know, giving us, you know, still commands. It's, you know, fascinating on his part that he had the abilities to continue that. So it was one of those moments where, you know, where were you? You know, there you are, right? And personally, I paused for a second, got it, you know, started tending to Pete's wounds, and with like a pressure dressing, they were on my heels. Shortly right behind me was my partner, Nick Bushiers. You know, and once again, he had the same medical training I did, you know, prior to coming in the Bureau, so he kicked into action, right?
He was in his normal battle kit, obviously, which had sustained some damage due to the explosion. And so, you know, and his rifle had been knocked from him a little bit a ways away. And so, you know, we had to quickly assess that situation. So I called for a medic and meanwhile applied a tourniquet to his leg, which was obviously amputated, and then started trying to address his other wounds. While that was happening, of note, you know, Pete displayed a tremendous amount of what I would call grit during that situation, in that Chris was doing his best to keep him conscious and to get information. But Pete was freely offering information. and trying to make sure that we understood what he knew up to the point of the incident happening. And so it was one of those situations, you know, hindsight being what it is and reflecting back on it, it's almost like a movie, because he was very calm in a situation where he could have had every right to lose his composure, lose his bearing, but he stayed professional throughout the whole ordeal, even as he was coming in and out of consciousness.
They call him Perfect Pete, you know, in the British bomb community. And there's a reason for that, you know. He was still giving his commands about the area he was walking, where he went, where he didn't go, stay away from this area, police his weapon, find his ammo, don't leave it behind, all those things that you would say. Where it's interesting, you know, as we're tending to Pete's wounds and we're stabilizing his injury, so I want to make sure he doesn't go into shock. You know, I said, Pete, your leg's broken. You know, it's gone, right? However, I don't know if he was aware of that at that moment. Just told him it was broken, just for the moment. At the same time, you know, just give him a little peace of mind. I said, and everything else is where it should be. All right. So that laid that out too, because, you know, everything was below the waist. You know, his injury of his leg. So I want to make sure he knew everything else was good to go. So we'll just say that.
Nick and Chris basically got to me first, from my recollection, and got down next to me, and basically just very lucky that both of them, from their previous military background and other jobs that they had done, were essentially paramedic trained. So they basically got to work to me. They had tourniquet, combat application tourniquet with them, so they applied that to my leg. I was attempting at the time, not I couldn't really see much, but attempting to get, I had a morphine injection in my pouches, which all the Brits carried, but actually turned out none of the Americans had. It was something that they weren't aware of as well. So I'm actually trying to get this thing out with my left hand. Little did I know that actually my left hand probably wasn't in any sort of condition at all to do anything, but I was like, why can't I get this open, sort of thing. Eventually gave up on that. I think they managed to find it, but then they didn't know how to use it.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, I've never monkeyed with this kit before, so I'm trying to figure out how to use it, you know, and this poor guy's in the worst pain of his life. And now I'm monkeying around with this kit and I broke it. You know, I broke his kit, right? So now I can't give him the morphine that he really needs. I mean, we laugh about it now. Yeah, but at the moment, you know, it was like, oh my gosh, I just wrecked it. So there's that. All right, so that was just an interesting kind of a moment, which after that never happened again. We trained up on the British kits, so we knew what to do in the future.
So when the medic arrived, the medic, I don't know, but I would say that the medic was a bit taken aback by the seriousness of Pete's injuries. And when he went to try to start an IV, he was visibly shaking. And it was Pete who actually was like, hey, it's going to be okay. You got this, mate. You know, I mean, you know, very, very, again, displaying a lot of grit in a situation that, you know, I think others would have folded.
Both Chris and Nick had started out their careers as firefighters, so were trained paramedics. Pete believes this saved his life. And despite his injuries and the pain he was in, Pete also saved theirs.
It comes back to this whole, you know, not happy about this place anyway, and clearly I've just been proven right. But there's one that's just got me. There's probably more, at least one, maybe, or two or three more. And what I didn't want, the worst thing that would have for me at that point, for them to then start wandering about and get hit on the way down. You know, there's nothing I could do about controlling them when they rushed to me to give first aid, but now that they're there. So, you know, it was essentially instructing them, don't go anywhere, I think there's more.
I can't help but back up and focus on the abilities Pete had, where he was giving us orders, his commands, as he was keeping us tight. There's another reason for that, right? That was part of the training, part of his experience. And once again, you know, we're focusing on him. We're kind of running around, making sure we're squaring him away. But at the same time, we're listening to him. We are staying close.
Well, they're there. They're treating me. They're reassuring me, telling me, you know, that I'm going to be all right, that I haven't lost my bits and all that sort of stuff. And I'm sort of more concerned really about their safety, because I don't want them to step outside this immediate area where I'm almost convinced that there's more devices. So once they've sort of got me to the point where they're happy, that they've stabilised me, they've got a tourniquet on, and they get a stretcher to me, then they take me back to the ICP. We're waiting for the Black Hawk to come in. I've obviously already called in the paramedic helicopter to come in. And they're continuing to reassure me and say that let the wife know I'm okay. But I'm still now convinced that we need to make sure that nobody else goes in tonight. There's more down there. It needs, rather than an intelligence clear out, it needs an EOD team to go in there. So before they put me on the helicopter, I get them to promise to me that nobody else is going to go in there tonight, that they'll hold the ground and get EOD team in tomorrow, which I understand they subsequently did.
So in a nutshell, it was harrowing, chaotic, terrifying. At the same time, it was inspiring in the fact of Pete's, his leadership, his behavior that he demonstrated on that scene. And some people will say, you guys saved him. No, he saved us. He did, through his actions, through his leadership and his gut feeling. He kept us in a position we could go home to our families. What we didn't know was about 12 feet away was not another secondary, but a tertiary, a third improvised explosive device that was buried in that location. Once again, that's a TTP that the insurgents would use. Very effective. But from Pete's actions, he kept us close. Had we gone down there on the first walk, we all could have been taken out. Had he not kept us close on our response to him, we would have been taken out, in my opinion.
So what made Pete think there might be more than one IED? It's something that's always puzzled Rigo.
My question for Pete is, was that a gut feeling? Because sometimes in our craft, we rely on that. And you can call it what you want. You can call it a gut feeling. You can call it a sixth sense. Some people might call it an angel on their shoulders, a little voice, woman's intuition. Depends on how you couch it. But I've always wondered for Pete if that kicked in on for him to keep us back by the Humvee. Well, he did the first check, after the area was even cleared.
I've got to be honest, that whole day, even before the incident came in, there was some, I'm not a believer in paranormal or anything like that, but that whole day, just within me, it felt like something's going to happen that day. Mm-hmm. And I had that feeling all the way up to the deployment, and then on the ground particularly. Yeah, I told the guys for quite a while afterwards that, I didn't have anything, but I did. Something wasn't right, without a doubt.
I guess you get evacuated and you don't see Nick or probably anyone else for quite some time.
I remember being put onto the helicopter, looking up and just seeing the roof inside this Black Hawk and people start leaning over me and trying to put stuff into me. And that's really my last memory, although I was informed that I was conscious all the way to central Baghdad, to the combat support hospital and onto the table. But that's where they basically put me into an induced coma. Did all that sort of life-saving surgery and then basically left me overnight to see whether or not I'd die or survive.
As we all know by now, Pete Norton is made of strong stuff. He made it through the night and was flown out to Ramstein in Germany to the US medical facility. After a few days there, he was moved back to Birmingham's Selly Oak Hospital.
So, I lost my left leg above the knee. My left arm basically got amputated just below the elbow. I lost 80% of the right buttock, all of the right hamstring, most of my sciatic nerve on the right, nothing worked below the knee, fractured ribs, fractured vertebra, collapsed lungs. I wasn't.
So there's a lot going on that's not visible as well.
Oh yeah, quite a bit. So I was in Selly Oak Hospital for almost a year before they then moved me down to Headley Court, which was our medical rehab facility at the time, down in near Leatherhead.
Yeah,
and I've been down there for a number of months, starting that whole sort of rehab process.
Yeah, and I guess everything you're doing in that rehab facility is quite energetic. You know, you're trying to learn new ways to move around and deal with...
Or just to move things.
Yeah.
You know, and having been in the hospital for so long with limited mobility, I mean, I think it was more than 3 months before I even managed to get out of the bed, nearly 6 months before I was out of the bed for the first time. So not ideal. But yeah, I'd been there for a few months and had, it was almost like being cut off, certainly at Selly Oak and even to a degree, because actually, if you think back even to 2005, all the smartphones that we've got now, the email on demand, it wasn't there. Mm. So actually, it was almost like being cut off from your friends, society and colleagues, put into isolation for a period, which was quite strange to adapt to with no contact. But eventually, I got two surprise visitors at Headley Court and Nick and Rigo were there.
There was no hesitation when we had an opportunity to visit Pete when he was at Headley Court shortly after we departed theater to see how he was coming along. And then from that point forward, we just stayed in touch and made sure that he was getting what he needed and just making sure that he knew he wasn't alone. And you know, back to that grit, his resiliency is also something that is just extremely admirable. To go through all the surgeries that he's gone through and all of the associated dynamics and impact that takes place on the family, it's impressive. And he, every time, comes through it at a level that is beyond comprehension.
Nick and Rigo weren't the only ones to be impressed by Pete. The army was too, and told him he was going to be awarded the George Cross.
So that was when I was still in Selly Oak in March 2006. And a colonel from MOD main building came along, who I didn't know, and basically said, look, we don't normally do this because it's normally released on the day, but because of your situation, you're still in hospital, we're going to give you sort of, as it were, a sneak preview, and you're going to be awarded the George Cross, which hit me like a sledgehammer, because I was fully aware of what the award was. Former colleagues of mine have received them in the past, and ammunition technicians and ATOs in the past have received them. So I'm fully aware of its standing and what it means. It hit me big.
The British Army is very thorough. They really are. I'm impressed with their processes and stuff. And they did an inquiry, you know, into the event that we all participated in. We were interviewed, you know, by the British investigators, you know, onto the what happened. And there's a follow-on later, which is to be expected. One of the commanders, Colonel Seddon, asked if I would be willing to write a letter for the Board of Inquiry. You know, I said, absolutely. It'd be my pleasure to do that. So, yeah, I wrote this letter, and I asked my unit chief, you know, hey, send this on to the Brits. Do I send it to the embassy and have them walk it over? Whatever. And, you know, my boss said, nope, send it right to the colonel, you know, direct. So, boink, send it. And that, you know, is this going to be part of this package? So the interesting thing was, it was about a month and a half later, Colonel calls me back, says Rigo, you know, thanks for the drafting the letter. Everything's good to go with the inquiry. No issues. Pete's doing great. He's in, you know, the hospital. He's had you know, multiple surgeries. And he advised that he was going to be awarded the George Cross, which is absolutely amazing, you know. And it was kind of funny how the colonel put it. He goes, yeah, your letter was part of that package. And actually, it was read by the Queen herself. And I was like, okay. So to my guys in my squad, I remind them, you know, be careful what you write. You never know who's going to read it.
So what did Pete's family and friends think at the time?
Obviously, everybody was, you know, supportive and surprised and in some, certainly from trade perspective, proud, I guess. Mm. It wasn't the best of times, sort of that point onwards, really, family-wise. Unfortunately, a year in hospital after, you know, 3-4 months on ops, followed by a year in rehab, and all the issues that go with that resulted in a breakdown of the marriage. It was just too much. And unfortunately, the army didn't really help. They didn't do as good a job as they could have in supporting the family and relieving the stresses that they were under. I'm not sure they even recognised it. So unfortunately, that was not a good time life-wise. So when I eventually left rehab, I didn't end up going back to a family. I ended up coming here to Shrivenham into a single room to start a master's course.
Right. So your life changed in a lot of ways.
Massively.
Really. Yeah. And I guess emotionally that must have taken
huge
its toll as
And that slowed the whole recovery down, to be honest. Complicated everything.
I guess, you know, and you say you came here to do a master's. Is that a way for you to put your mind into something?
It provided that. I mean, it wasn't the reason. I actually got blown up 3 weeks before I was due to leave and come here and do that master's anyway. Mm. And you know, thankfully, the MOD kept the place open for me. So when I eventually did return from rehab, I was able to go straight into that and get on with that. So that sort of provided me with a focus whilst trying to deal with all the other things that were going on in life at the time as well.
And I guess you went to Buckingham Palace. Was it a Buckingham Palace?
It was. Slightly unusual, to be honest. So normally, something like the George Cross and the Victoria Cross, you would get presented by Her Majesty the Queen. But I don't know if you can cast your mind back to 2006, late 2006. It's one of the very few times during her reign when Her Majesty has had to stop doing duties.
Oh, really?
She had a bad back.
Okay.
Which must have been bad for her to stop
doing
duties. But
I'm going to say, I bet it was not her decision.
But the whole thing, the whole investiture had already been sort of booked up. I'd already accepted the dates. We'd got lunches booked for people and the whole thing. I was still at Headley Court at the time. I actually got a call the day before from the palace, and I'm sure not many people get calls like this saying, you know, Her Majesty sends apologies, but she's not going to be able to do the investiture tomorrow. Would you like to reschedule? I had a quick think on my feet, and it's like, oh, I've got so much organised. Other people booked, you know, co-chairs, dinners in Regent's Park, barracks and all that. It's like, you know what, I can't. I'm afraid I'm going to have to continue. So I think I'm probably the only person who's had a George Cross presented by Princess Anne. And she, at the time, said, you know, this, I never get to give these out. And it was quite nice in some respects, as much as a disappointment as it was not to have it presented by Her Majesty. At least Princess Anne was our Colonel in Chief, and I'd met her on a couple of occasions. So it was quite special in that respect as well. And the palace were fantastic.
But it wasn't the only honour Pete received.
One of my counterparts, one of the Special Agent Bomb Technicians who knew Pete, who was in Iraq, he's like, hey, why don't you put Pete in for the FBI star? I'm like, that's usually only for FBI agents. It's kind of like a Purple Heart for FBI agents. He goes, yeah, but he's part of your team. And I'm like, you know what? You're right. So I kind of had the letter written earlier, the one I sent for the inquiry. And, you know, I just kind of retooled it a little bit and I sent it to FBI Director Mueller at the time, you know, for consideration. You know, once again, he's a foreign national. He's not an on-duty FBI agent. And it was pretty awesome. It came back. They went, absolutely, he's going to get that. And I think he's one of the first, if not in conjunction with another foreign national, that got the FBI star first ones in our history. It's pretty neat.
So the FBI star is awarded for actions which result in serious injury. And, you know, that's typically in the course of a hostile action. And so given that we were in a team environment and given that our team was responsible for conducting what I think could be best described as rule of law operations in addition to force protection, my colleague Chris was like, hey, what do you think about this? I said, you know, that is fantastic. That is a terrific idea. And he's most deserving of it.
Yeah, that was a weird one. That was a few years afterwards, actually. And I think it was 2010 off the top of my head. I can't remember exactly now. I was actually, so I'd finished my master's degree and I'd stayed on as a directing staff and lecturer at Shrivenham at the Defence Academy. And I was in the office and I got a phone call and it was like, hi, I'm from the FBI. I was like, oh, you don't get these calls every day. And we'd like to give you an award. Could you come over on this date? And unfortunately, the first thing I had to say is, I don't know, actually, because I've got to get approval from main building. So they literally phoned me up directly.
So it hadn't come via the MOD?
No, I hadn't gone through the MOD or anything. So I said, look, let me call you back. And I phoned up the MOD desk at Honours, because having already sort of got the George Cross by then, I got them on speed dial pretty much.
Yeah.
And I phoned up and said, look, I've just had a phone call from the FBI. They want to give me an FBI star and go over there to an official award ceremony. Are you okay with this? And the female major at the other end went, no, you're not allowed to. It's not. And I says, hold on a second. You want me to turn around to the FBI and say, no, thanks. I'm not. You can stick your award. She went, yeah, you can't. I says, I'll tell you what, you and me never had this phone call.
I'm off to the States.
Well, I'm off to the States. So she basically went, yeah, we never had this phone call. So I phoned them back, said, yeah, give us the dates.
I do have a little video to show you, which we like to drop this on everyone. So I'm just going to key it up and then you get to see the amazing FBI setup. Hola. Can you see that all right?
Yeah.
It's quite loud, so you should hear
okay.
it.
Yeah, so, you know, obviously when you're in combat, which is kind of hard to describe unless you've been there, you do form a bond. Even with individuals that you may not necessarily associate with on a non-combat basis. So there's definitely a bit of a brotherhood in that respect.
But we're way past that. It's not a friendship. It's a brotherhood. And that's something that that you endure together. And we have become family. I see we, Pete, Nick, and I, have the three of us, have become very close over the years, sharing personal events, family events.
The biggest thing I can say to Pete is thank you. And I would not be where I am now. I would not have the family that I have now if it wasn't for Pete and for his grit. And again, just being himself. And so that is something that will always, always resonate with me.
But the message I guess I'd say is, you know, I want to thank you, Pete. You saved our lives on that horrific day. And our families are in gratitude to you as well. So it's our pleasure to be now related to you because you're stuck with us. All right, that's my message.
Brilliant.
Sorry, I didn't want to drop that on you. That is Rigo and Nick.
Yep.
To your FBI colleagues, who you're now really close friends, you know, as they say, family.
Family, yeah.
And
godfathers to my daughters.
Mm.
Yeah. They're great guys.
Yeah.
I could not have wished for any better people
to
work with without them.
We've had some stories.
The FBI, they play it all straight officially, but they can be a bit naughty, actually.
Yeah.
And so can Pete. Rigo had told me a story about when he took Pete to a Halloween party in the US.
So, I mean, one of the things that we sort of haven't touched on is that whilst I was here doing my master's, I sort of got divorced, and I met a wonderful girl called Kate, who was doing her PhD, and basically we fell in love and got married in 2013, which is where we now have two young daughters. But the two of us were over in the States visiting the guys, and it was around Halloween time, so that they invited us along to one of their colleagues' Halloween parties, and the Americans do these big Halloween parties.
Yeah.
Well, here's Pete's crazy sense of humor and his wife, Kate. They're two peas in a pod. Pete was going to go as a zombie patient, okay? His wife is going to be the zombie doctor. So imagine they got the whole zombie persona going on, right? Well, Pete used his limbs or lack of limbs as part of his costume, including like a bloody stumps and cut off pants and stuff like that. He absolutely, you know, took it to the next level. And Kate, as the doctor, you know, she's all, you know, geared up the same way. They looked awesome. The pictures are great.
A couple of years ago, Pete had his right leg amputated above the knee.
Originally, I wanted them to get rid of the right leg, but they wouldn't do it. They just wanted to save as much as they could. So I ended up living sort of in a wheelchair and with that right leg holding me back in many respects, because it's practically a dead weight, holding that for some, 14, 15 years. And then in 2019, after what was actually a long battle against the system, particularly the NHS, but the part of an MOD and NHS trial, I flew out to Sydney in Australia. I had my right leg amputated above the knee. And in the same operation, two titanium rods inserted, one up into each femur, which I can basically just always stick out the end of my legs now. And then I can attach prosthetic knees directly.
Right. And was that new? Is that why that...
It's a relatively new thing. It's been around for a number of times, but it's not widespread. It's certainly not available directly on the NHS at the moment, right, although hopefully it will be. But basically it means that I can now... I am in the middle of learning to walk on microprocessor knees.
Your decision and your fighting,
yes,
to get it done,
yeah,
has allowed you then to move on to the next step, which was holding you.
Yeah, so I, earlier this year, January, I took receipt of my new knees, as it were, and had them fitted and everything set up. And I've had a couple of rehab sessions, typically about 3 weeks at a time now. I put the Defence Medical Rehab, at the new one at Stanford Hall, where I've now successfully been able to walk several hundred metres, some of it using just a stick at the moment. Still on relatively flat, even surfaces.
Like you say, it's been a lot of years, so you've
got
a lot of...
It is, and I've got to build up core strength and learn. Yeah, a lot of muscle memory's been lost. So that's an ongoing thing at the moment. Keeping busy with work, running my own consultancy for a few things, and just... passed an interview and been accepted to do a PhD here at Cranfield.
An extract from Pete Norton's citation reads, "Before allowing them to render first aid, he instructed his team on which areas were safe and where they could move. Despite having sustained grievous injuries, he remained in command and coolly directed the follow-up actions. It is typical of the man that he ignored his injuries and regarded the safety of his men as paramount, as they administered life-saving first aid to him. It is of note that a further device was discovered less than 10 metres away and rendered safe the following day. Norton's precise and clear orders, in the most difficult of circumstances, undoubtedly prevented serious injury or loss of life."
Tea and Medals by BFBS Creative is presented by Darren Coventry. You can find out more about this episode at forces.net/teaandmedals. Tell us what you think. Email us at podcasts@bfbs.com. Tea and Medals is written and produced by Josella Waldron and Simon Thornton, edited by Andy Prada, with sound design by Mark Pittam. Original music is by Will Farmer. Our executive producer is Alex Griffiths. With thanks to Major Pete Norton, GC, Nick Beauchears and Chris Rigopoulos. We'll be right back.